On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Loeb is bringing AI to the masses, and Microsoft thinks that's a good idea. California is forcing companies to have more diverse boards. Facebook is punishing news sites using fact checkers. And Curtis, Brian, and I bring back a great guest from DiviCoin, Nick Saponaro, to talk about crypto, security, and ease of use. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet. This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 308, recorded September 14th, 2018. Proof of Stake Cryptocurrency. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And by Grammarly, the communication tool that helps improve your writing for every occasion. Start writing more confidently for work, school, and even on the go. It's a great way to double check your important papers, documents, and even avoid future typos. Get 20% off Grammarly Premium today at grammarly.com/enterprise. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Wasabi's disruptive cloud storage technology is helping enterprises solve one of their fastest growing issues, data storage. See for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial, and use offer code ENTERPRISE. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need a little help from some of the juggernauts in the enterprise industry, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor of Dark Reading. Curtis, how's the weather down there in the swamp today?
Oh, well, weather is fine. It is a great day down here in Florida. Looking out the window, we've got mostly sunny skies, and it's in the low 90s. So a beautiful, crisp fall day for Central Florida. And we're just sending good thoughts and prayers to the folks up in the mid-Atlantic states, hoping that that hurricane doesn't just stall out and dump foot after foot of rain on them.
Absolutely. I'm actually traveling down there in a couple of weeks. So I'm hoping that the weather will hold out. Now, you're getting ready for conference season down there, right?
I am indeed. And I've actually gotten some good news. I'm going to be at the same conference you will be. I'm going to be covering the Microsoft Ignite event in a couple of weeks. The week following that, first week of October, I will be at Splunk's conference. And then a couple of weeks past that, Gartner brings the CIOs of the world together for the Gartner Symposium, and I will be spending time over there. So lots of goodness to talk about for the coming weeks. Looking forward to bringing all of that to the Twiet Riot.
Fantastic. Yeah, we're definitely burning the midnight oil for Ignite coming up soon. Well, folks, we want to bring the more experts we bring into the show, the more viewpoints we can bring in. So why not bring in Mr. Brian McHenry from F5 Networks. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Lou.
Now, you're running security over there in F5 Networks right now, now in your new position, right?
Yeah, so I'm heading up our security efforts on the sales side of the business and helping customers and our technical salespeople alike understand how to bring all of F5 security solutions to bear.
Fantastic. Well, guys, thanks for being here. I'm looking forward to today's topics. So we're talking about Facebook and how they're policing news sites. Plus, we're going back to talk about cryptocurrency and how they're evolving for the masses. But first, like we always do, let's jump into the blips. Now, machine learning and AI is not for the average computer user or the faint of heart. Now, do you know of TensorFlow, Keras, or PyTorch? If you don't, you got to get your learn on, because there's lots to do here. Well, what if building machine learning models could be as easy as dragging and dropping icons? Well, that's what the startup Loeb thinks they can do for you, bring machine learning and AI to the masses. They provide a visual tool that allows you to build custom deep learning models quickly, train them, and then ship them directly in an app without writing code. Now, you can drag your trained data set into Loeb, adjust some parameters in the model, watch the model be trained in real time, and once done, export your TensorFlow or Core ML models and run them right in your application. Now, another cool feature I found was they actually provide a visual for how your data looks. Sound cool? Well, Microsoft thought so too. They are in the process of acquiring Loeb, even though they are still in beta. Now, to me, it seems like Loeb is an interesting complement to Microsoft's current Azure ML Studio, which offers a drag-and-drop interface to construct ML models. Microsoft also recently bought Banzai AI, a deep reinforcement learning platform, and Semantic Machines, a conversational AI platform. I don't know about you, but I see a pattern. What do you think? Will AI be important in the coming years?
So the European Court of Human Rights found that the mass surveillance scheme used by the GCHQ, which is United Kingdom's Signals Intelligence Agency, violated the European Convention on Human Rights, unlawfully intruding on the private and family life and freedom of expression of British and European citizens. The case included consideration of intelligence collected by the U.S. National Security Agency shared with GCHQ. The information shared via the Five Eyes Alliance does not violate human rights, but using such data to bypass restrictions is a violation. The ruling found there was insufficient oversight on the bulk collection and use of information by GCHQ. The suit, brought jointly by Big Brother Watch, Amnesty International, the ACLU and others, is aimed at sending a clear message to U.S. and foreign intelligence agencies that mass surveillance will not be tolerated. The court did not find evidence of abuse of these mass surveillance powers, however, but did not see enough checks and balances to ensure such abuses did not and could not occur. As policies like the GDPR seek to ensure greater privacy protections, it's become clear through rulings like this one, as well as Edward Snowden's leaked documents, that intelligence agencies and law enforcement have enjoyed more than two decades of relatively unfettered access to our communications. It will be up to us as technology consumers and conscientious citizens to demand better laws protecting us, as well as better technologies encrypting our communications end to end, without any so-called secret government backdoors or master keys.
Well, talking about bad software and bad things, modular malware is making it to the big time. Now, modular downloaders aren't new to the world of malware, but a new campaign featuring modular software launched by a major criminal group is drawing the attention of threat researchers. Researchers at Proofpoint discovered a pair of modular downloaders this summer and noticed two unusual factors in their use. First, the loaders were being very careful to conduct reconnaissance on the infected systems to decide whether the full payload would be downloaded. Next, the downloaders with very small and carefully obfuscated footprints were being launched by the Cobalt Group, which is a major criminal organization previously tied to little activities like ATM jackpotting and other major high-dollar criminal activities, along with some other criminal groups. The process of infecting a target machine is a three-step flow, with each step adding functionality. First module comes as an attachment to a phishing email. If the VBS code exploit can execute, it immediately sends a request for the second stage downloader, which does some reconnaissance on the target system, and then, if the system is clean from the malware's perspective, downloads the final payload and establishes persistence. All of this happens in a matter of, a couple of seconds. And since the criminal malware world follows news of successful campaigns, look for more of this kind of modular malware coming to your inbox in the near future.
Now, organizations are advocating for more diversity in the workplace, but California thinks they need to do more and have more diversity at the helm of organizations, too. Now, with the introduction of Bill SB 826, it will require companies with principal executive offices in the state of California to have a minimum number of women on their board. It's proportionate to the total number of board members. Now, if passed, This looks like it will disrupt some of the big tech companies in the area, including Alphabet, Google, Facebook, Intel, Snap, Apple, and Tesla, causing a move in seats to include one or more women on their boards. Now, what happens if you don't follow the rules? Well, you're fined $100,000 initially and then $300,000 for every subsequent violation. Now, currently in the industry, and not just in tech, the average is about 18% of board members are occupied by women members. Now, advocates of this bill want to see a rise of 50% or more over the next year. There are mixed feelings about this bill, causing positive and negative points of views of the rules. If anything, it makes a statement that things need to change.
One-third of data breaches lead to firings, according to a report released this week by Kaspersky Labs. This news is sure to keep CISOs up at night, with 31% of over 6,000 respondents in IT roles indicating that a data breach led to subsequent layoffs. Now, this report also found that large enterprises were much more likely to be breached than small businesses of less than 1,000 employees. North American businesses were most impacted by data breaches, according to a report, with over 40% indicating they'd experienced a breach. Now, this might be due to the higher visibility of breaches that have occurred in North America, and also to new laws requiring disclosure of these breaches by North American companies. However, most interestingly in this report, North American businesses were much more likely to fire a C-level role impacted by the breach.
So there's a new cold boot exploit that bypasses, oh, let's call it all the security. An updated version of the cold boot attack lets threat actors bypass security mechanisms and access data that remains in memory after a machine shuts down. Researchers report that modern machines from Apple, Dell, Lenovo, and other major firms are affected. Now, the cold boot attack itself isn't new. It's been known since 2008 and lets attackers with physical access to a machine steal its encryption keys, which tend to briefly remain in memory after a hard reboot. Most devices now protect against this with a Trusted Computing Group, or TCG, mitigation that overwrites data when the machine is rebooted. Now, it's important to know that this new exploit requires physical access to the machine and, frankly, quite a lot more. But if someone steals a computer filled with sensitive data, it could become an issue. To protect sensitive info, at a minimum, Microsoft has recommended using a device with a discrete Trusted Platform Module, or TPM, disabling the sleep and hibernation functions, and configuring BitLocker with a personal identification number. Apple says that Macs equipped with an Apple T2 chip come with security measures designed to protect devices from attacks like this one, and it advises users to set a firmware password to secure Macs that don't have that T2 chip. Oh, and from me, lock your doors. Seems like a basic first step when it comes to cybersecurity.
Now, you may have heard of the Google X project. Well, now with the independent Alphabet company, the project is now dubbed Project Loom. Now, what is it? Well, imagine helium balloons floating around with solar-powered electronics on board, providing radio links with telecommunication networks on the ground. It can beam down high-speed cellular internet coverage to smartphones and other places where it's hard to add ground coverage for such networks. Was the name the only change when it moved to Alphabet? Nope, with the shift. The project has also developed an antenna system that increases the coverage area of the network to almost 620 miles for one balloon. In addition to the network coverage, one of the most significant developments was a way to accurately pilot balloons across thousands of miles without any form of propulsion. Winds blow in different directions and different speeds in different layers of the stratosphere. Loon balloons actually exploit that by changing altitude. As a smaller balloon inside the main one inflates or deflates, they can rise or fall to seek out the winds that will send them where Loon wants them to go. The target of this project is to try and provide network coverage to 4.3 billion people who live in rural places where telecommunication companies haven't found it worthwhile to actually build cell towers or other infrastructure. Now, without competition, this is not without competition, including Facebook's project using similar technology. Now, Project Loom is almost ready to ship and start floating worldwide to provide places like Brazil, Australia, and New Zealand with cellular coverage and internet that they didn't have before. Our hopes, one hopes that this will be on the rise and the rise to success. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But first, we have to thank this week a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, home buying is not easy. It's stressful. I actually remember buying my last house. It was not fun. I had to deal with multiple banks, constant communications with different bank reps. I had to search around in my file cabinets for information, and I had to worry about interest rate hikes during the process. Now, it's nerve-wracking, and it seems to take forever. Now, the market today is unpredictable, which means interest rates are actually changing all the time, and it causes a lot of anxiety. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage noticed all the pitfalls in the process and are doing something about it. They are calling it the power buying process. Now, here's how it works. Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, credit in less than 24 hours and give you a verified approval. Now, what is that? Well, this gives you the strength of a cash buyer. And in this current market, that is a huge advantage as a buyer because sometimes you have to put offers at a moment's notice, actually right at open houses. Now, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here is the best part. If the rate goes up during that time, yours actually stays the same. Now, you're probably thinking, well, if the rate goes down, they won't tell me about it. Nope, that's not true. If the rate goes down, your rate actually also drops. This is just the kind of thinking and programs you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender, Rocket Mortgage. Now, if you're thinking about buying a home or a house, go out right now to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. In less than 10 minutes, your info could be entered and you're on your way to home buying freedom. Now, to get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records, equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into the blips. Now, imagine that your business is coming to a screeching halt because of the word said. Now, in the attempt to crack down on the amount of false news stories posted on their site, Facebook uses fact checkers. Now, who are the fact checkers? Well, they're a set of five news outlets which Facebook relies on to fact check articles posted on their site. Now, before I go on, let that sink in for a second. They use other news sites to fact check completely separate news sites. Now, a recent article by Think Progress called out their interpretation of the views of a DC judge and a Supreme Court nominee about Roe versus Wade. Now, the article was titled "Brett Kavanaugh said he could kill Roe versus Wade last week and almost no one noticed." Now, that was a title. Now, the article's content uses speeches and comments by the Supreme Court nominee to actually disambiguate the judge's views on the famous court ruling. Now, this must have struck one of the fact checkers' nerves because they marked the site's article with a false rating. Why? Well, because the judge didn't literally say the word that he would overturn anything. Now, what's even more unfortunate here is that the 10 to 15% of the readers of Think Progress are actually from Facebook's referrals. So Think Progress says that when it's disputed the false rating to Facebook, a Facebook employee actually responded by email saying that Facebook defers to each independent fact checker's process and publishers are responsible for reaching out to the fact checkers directly to request a correction. All right, I'm going to stop there because this kind of makes my blood boil a little bit when I think about it. But I do want to throw it over to you guys because I want to get your thoughts on this. Is this way out in left field, or is this a legitimate way to verify news stories? Curtis, what do you think?
Well, in terms of verifying the news stories, I think it's fine. When you look at the groups that they lean on, it's organizations like PolitiFact and such. And while they are run by news organizations, they are separate from the news gathering organizations. PolitiFact is a Pulitzer Prize winning group. It started at the St. Pete Times, which is owned, one has to say, by a foundation, not by a normal private owner. So it is owned by the Poynter Foundation, and the Poynter Foundation does a lot of journalism education. So it's an interesting hybrid. It's not the sort of for-profit media organization we think of. The thing that's important to note is that they got into trouble for a headline, and no one really has called into question the contents of the article. If you look at the article, in the article, it never reports that he literally said that thing. They sort of show how they got there. The people who write the article and the person who writes the headline are almost always separate. I know very, very few organizations consisting of more than one person where the writer, the correspondent, writes the headline. Headline writing is its own art. There are people who are good at it. And these days, those people also tend to be good at things like search engine optimization. You're writing not just to attract human eyeballs, but to attract placement on sites like Google and Bing and the other search engines. So I think what this may well be doing is confusing things because, you know, Facebook has been open about the fact that they are struggling to get this right. They are going to make some mistakes. And I think this probably was one. At the same time, we have to say that this is the sort of thing that people on the more progressive side of the scale have been talking about and doing to those organizations that are more conservative for some time. Now, you can get into all kinds of arguments about which is better, which is worse, which is farther along the spectrum than the other. But what we're seeing in a lot of different cases is a tactic, once it's used, will be picked up by those all along the political spectrum. So this is the first volley. I suspect we're going to see a lot more of this in the coming weeks as we head toward the midterms, and it's going to do nothing but get more and more heated as we head toward the national elections in 2020.
Right. I think the interesting part here, I mean, I'm sure that the five or six news outlets that they chose are actually, you know, fairly good news outlets. They're reputable in that case. But there's always that thing in my back of my head about competition, obviously. That's the first thing. And the second thing is there's always a room for human error here. Like you were saying, the same people don't always actually write the article titles versus the content. And they're more of sometimes trying to get you kind of grabbed into that article to actually get to the site so you can just start reading the content. But I think, in this case, I mean, it's pretty clear just by reading the article that they weren't saying that the judge actually said these things, that they were just rationalizing these things out of out of different things that he did and that he said. So Brian, I want to throw this over to you. So what do you think? Is by using these other news sites to regulate things, do you think that this is the best course of action? Will this help?
Well, is it the best course of action? Probably not, right? It's the first try. So eventually, you know, things will improve. But I think a transparent system like what Facebook is trying here, because they realize the influence they have, at least better late than never, is better than, you know, sort of the honor systems which we had before, right? We hope that someone notices an error, and we hope that people report accurately because that's the job of a journalist. And now we've moved into, you know, sort of this post-truth era, if you will, and social media playing such a big part in creating filter bubbles where people engage in what's known as confirmation bias, right? Seeking out someone who wrote something that validates their opinion, whether it's based on truth or not. And certainly we can look at any set of statistics and twist numbers to bend to support a certain perspective or and get away from what you might want to call objective truth. But I do think some kind of transparent system like this, this is almost certainly not the right thing, right? But it's a, it's at least an effort. And what Facebook is doing, say, this is, these are the consequences for bad reporting, which I don't think there's ever been anything other than, you know, fear of a libel suit or, you know, scout's honor in the past to keep us all honest. And we have a really, a real proliferation of trying to establish credibility for lots of emerging news outlets in the age of the internet.
Right. So on a different note, I think fact checking using kind of other kind of organizations seems to almost be rudimentary in this technological world that we live in. And we know that Facebook, you know, likes to take sometimes, you know, the steps to the edge technologies, you know, balloon given internet and other things like that. In fact, I know of multiple Facebook employees that say that they can't even send a memo out without routing data through a machine learning model pipeline at Facebook. So why not do that for news too? So I don't actually get this. Now, I remember actually hearing about Reuters introducing a new tool called News Tracer. It's a capability. Now, its capability is actually apply AI in journalism to find events breaking by applying a newsworthiness score so people can focus on the events that are important. Now, this is Reuters doing this, not a social networking giant that has access to tons of machine learning models up the wazoo. So I think this is a very strange that they chose this like beginning process almost to say, hey, we don't really care about this. We'll just hand it off to these other people to kind of handle it. And we'll be open about it, but we're just not going to deal with it, which seems very strange to me. But this could affect an organization's bottom line as well, as we're seeing with this particular news outlet. Their entire traffic is being affected by the fact they're being blocked by Facebook. Now, I want to throw this over to Curtis because you have some experience with this, is the ways that news outlets are funded. This could affect a lot of them if they just have bad headlines, right?
Well, here's the thing. The reason that the headlines are so important is that the headlines, especially as they play with search engine optimization, is critical because statistically, no one visits the homepage of an organization. I mean, you look at something like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. Statistically, and I don't have any inside information on these two organizations. I just chose them at random. But if they are like other news organizations, statistically, no one goes to the homepage. Virtually everyone who reads an article will get there through some sort of either social media link or a search engine link. And therefore, since you are paying as the publisher, you are paid by the advertisers who want to see a certain number of eyeballs in a, you know, in the course of a month, say, you have the economic drive to get those eyeballs, get those clicks. You know, whether you measure it in page views or clicks on an ad or click-throughs or sessions, you want to get people to an article. How do you do that? Through the headline. And therefore, the importance of the headline is bigger now than it was in the days of print. Because if you don't have a good machine catchy headline, Lou, to get to your point about machine learning, you're not going to get people to read the article. And that's why this kind of true or false statement based solely on the contents of the headline is, I think, somewhat problematic. Right. I think that what the organizations need to be doing is looking more heavily at the content of the article. Is the article itself true, false, some sort of mix? The problem with that, of course, is that it takes longer to read the entire article. It requires longer to fact check the entire article. And you get right back to this whole issue of cost. The fact checking is not something that makes money for these organizations, regardless of what they are. So, you know, it all gets back to economics and the same issues that caused people to turn away from paper are going to be playing to how people have an impact, you know, or what has an impact on this. And I'll also say, I have some issues with the whole notion of machine learning for fact checking, primarily because having been immersed in machine learning and AI for a little while because of some things I'm writing, the thing that all of the experts keep coming back to is the training. And that training tends to be done by humans. So you end up with a machine learning engine that reflects the biases of the humans doing the training, which means that it can be biased only 10 times faster. I agree with Brian. Transparency is going to be the key because there are going to be mistakes. There are going to be differences of opinion. And I think to the extent that an organization like Facebook can be transparent, then we can at least all know what we're disagreeing about. And that in and of itself would be a step forward from a lot of the debates happening online these days.
Right, right. Now, Brian, I want to throw this back to you. I think that you were talking a little bit about in the chat here about consolidation of traffic, right?
Facebook and Google really have a massively disproportionate amount of control over what actually gets seen. Where does our internet traffic go? And so while maybe machine learning is imperfect and while the policy that they've published is imperfect, we do need – if they don't stay transparent, then we head down a path of what seems like an absurd notion when you hear it bandied about, nationalizing Facebook and Google as utility services, right? Making them, essentially government-controlled entities. Those things sound insane until you realize how much control Facebook and Google can assert over what actually gets seen by our citizenship. So, it's really important that Facebook and Google remain transparent, not just because we want to make sure things are fair and everything's right. They need to stay transparent because they want to sidestep these issues of nationalization and being treated as a utility service because of just how much centralized control they have over internet traffic and what gets seen, right? It's no longer, they have so much power in the tip of their hand, the tips of their fingertips, that it's a little bit scary. And that's why people talk about, things that's, again, seem absurd on the face of it, like nationalizing them as utilities. But it actually has some merit when you start to consider the impact of them, sort of doing things in a secret squirrel fashion.
Right. Right. I think the interesting thing is they are calling out, hey, we're being transparent about this. We're letting you know that there's these organizations which are reputable that are going to be reviewing things so that we can kind of control a little bit more of what they like to call fake news on the site and control this type of thing, clickbait type of thing. Hopefully, this will pan out and things will get better. And we'll see what Facebook has to do, especially as the midterms come up. Great discussion, but it is time to move on. And when we come back, we are going to talk a bit about cryptocurrencies and bringing it to the masses. But first, we have to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Grammarly. Now, there is always that one tool that helps you so much that you keep coming back to it. And for me, when I write, it's definitely Grammarly. Now, not only does it help me write better content, but it also helps me with emails write too. Now, for instance, Grammarly will help you correct your writing skills by helping with grammar, phrases, sentences, and even the free version helps with spelling grammar and can literally make you write better. Now, Grammarly Premium adds some great features. In addition to spelling and grammar, Grammarly Premium helps with advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, readability for different occasions, and more. Now, for me, it definitely is more enjoyable when you use this tool. I trust that I won't actually send bad content anymore because I can actually lean on Grammarly. Now, it makes it really convenient. It actually integrates with Microsoft Word and Outlook, and they have extensions in all the major browsers from Chrome, Edge, Safari, Firefox. And now if you travel a lot, maybe you're taking public transportation and you use your phone for everything, Grammarly has you covered as well. It works with iOS and Android. And for me on iOS, the Grammarly keyboard is a lifesaver. Autocomplete can sometimes fail you. Oh, look at all those funny posts out there people have with autocomplete fails. Well, the Grammarly keyboard can keep you safe here. Not only will you actually write better, but it just looks better too. Now, if you haven't tried Grammarly yet, Go get it now. Grammarly.com/enterprise to get 20% off Grammarly Premium today. That is Grammarly.com/enterprise. And we thank Grammarly for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, this is my favorite part of the show. We get to bring a guest in on the Twilight Ride and drop some knowledge on us. And this time it's no exception because we actually had them back on episode 279. And they were just getting started, but they've made some strides since then. And we want to talk more about cryptocurrency and security. So we thought, hey, let's bring back Nick Saponaro from the Divvy Project, co-founder. He's a co-founder over there at the Divvy Project. Welcome back, Nick.
Thanks for having me on, Lou. Glad to be back.
Absolutely. So you guys have been quite busy over there since we've talked last time. Why don't you give the let's take a step back first, because some of our listeners, maybe they missed that episode, maybe they didn't go back and listen. Why don't we just give the audience a quick refresher on Divvy Coin and what it is and what makes it different?
Yeah, so Divvy is a project that was created to make cryptocurrency more accessible to the average user and kind of take out all of the technical jargon and difficulty with entering into cryptocurrency usage and earning cryptocurrency.
Right. And so I think the last episode we've talked about some features that you're working on. How has it kind of evolved between then and now? I think it was back in February is when you guys were kind of just getting started.
Yeah, so we've definitely come a long way since then. We're actually finishing up our beta testing for our version 1 that's going to be launching at the end of this month, the end of September. And we're extremely excited to finally be at this point and hopefully bring some newcomers into the cryptocurrency sphere.
Right. So now, last time we talked a little bit about kind of what makes the Divvy Project, Divvy Coin, a little different. We talked about the differences between proof of work and proof of stake and how there's different, obviously, cryptocurrencies that use either or. I think the audience was still kind of a little bit confused on the difference between the two and what kind of Divvy Coin was using. Can you maybe take us through those two advantages, disadvantages of both, and maybe talk about what Divvy Coin's using?
Sure, definitely. So proof of work is the traditional consensus mechanism that most of the earlier cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin use. It's very energy intensive. It takes a very powerful machine now to earn a block on the Bitcoin blockchain, which has caused scalability issues. And other cryptocurrency projects are experiencing the same slowdown and issues with scaling. Proof of stake is about 99% more energy efficient, uses 99% less energy than proof of work. It can be run on pretty much any machine. Our software is able to be run on a machine with at least 2 gigabytes of RAM and we want to say 20 gigabytes of hard drive space. So pretty much anything. The benefit with proof of stake is that it does offer more scalability potential. And we've already seen some larger projects utilizing proof of stake, or a new one called delegated proof of stake, that allow for much faster transaction times, more transactions per second, and just general scalability for things like M2M, machine learning and AI and things of that nature.
So you called out a little bit. The advantage of proof of stake is that you can almost bootstrap a lower kind of lower end device. Now, how low are we talking? Are we talking mobile device? It's still desktop device?
Right now, we're still looking at desktop. Mobile is a bit trickier because of the need for persistent connection. While our phones are always on typically, the ecosystem does require that your node is connected to the network all the time. So always on, which we can't guarantee with a cell phone. We do want to bring proof of stake to cell phones, mobile devices. But that would be a little bit further out in our scope.
Right. That makes sense. Now proof of stake blocks, they need to be obviously still created by someone. And in fact, whoever gets the next block is based off of this special proof of stake algorithm that you use. And so randomness is still required here, but not fully random, because there's still a need for a distributed voting system here. Right. So does this kind of bring it back to a more centralized system, or does it still keep it decentralized?
It's still decentralized. So we have a pretty unique algorithm that we've created. So in our ecosystem, there are stakers and there are master nodes. And the system sort of uses both of those types of nodes to come to a consensus. It still requires the consensus of the network to generate a new block, but of course one node earns the block reward. Now we've improved upon the system by creating what we call a layered or a tiered system of master nodes. So in traditional architecture, even with some of the newer architecture with the tiered nodes that I'm seeing out there, they basically work in a queue system. So your node or your master node lines up, and once it gets to the front of the line, it wins a block, and then it goes to the back of the line. We didn't feel like that was really truly consensus or really truly random enough. So what we've developed is basically a lottery system. Your master node, depending on the level, gets a certain number of, we'll call them tickets, and it still has the potential to lose and not earn that block, but the higher levels of masternode have more tickets, essentially, so a higher chance at earning, and their earnings are higher in general. So in that way, we've sort of randomized it, if you will, and we've kept it decentralized that way as well.
Interesting. So I think, you know, we've seen let me try to explain this back to you, because I'm trying to kind of wrap my head around it a little bit. So you basically have each validator, similar to the miners of the proof of work thing, has to put out stake into the network, money in this case. And then that more the stake, the better chance they have to be selected as the next node to create block. Or is it you're saying that they've added more randomness into that system?
Yeah. So the more each individual node is staking, the higher, obviously, chance or potential at earning a block that that particular node has. The master nodes don't technically stake. The funds are allocated to the node. I don't want to say locked, because they're not. It's not like you can't get them out. You can always stop the master node and use the funds. Right. But yeah, you're essentially correct. Each node has a particular stake in the network. The network allows that node to participate in the voting or the consensus mechanism, because it says, this is not a bad actor. This is a guy or a girl or node who has literally a stake in this system and would not act against it, you know, to try to create a fork or a hard fork off the network. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. So I'll play a devil's advocate here for a second. Now that you said that the more you stake you put in, the better chances. Now the question to you would be, does that maybe favor people who have lots more money than the rest? So just like proof of work, it means that you have the bigger rig you have, the better chance you have is to generate one of these nodes. But with this one, it's the more money you have?
Yeah, so to some degree, yeah. Of course, the more you're able to put into the system, the higher chance you have at earning. That said, the system is very rewarding, wherein you can get up to the next levels by just running even a staking node. And if you leave it running for long enough, you'll have enough to start a copper node or, you know, get to the next level of node. So we've made with the ticketing system, we've made it, I think, as fair as possible, while still, you know, adding value or allowing for people with more stake to add more value to the ecosystem, because those bigger nodes can process more information and make the network inherently more secure. So we need those people, and we want to incentivize those people to stick around, you know?
Right. So there are obviously some other proof of stake cryptocurrencies out there, and some of them use different selection algorithms. Like for instance, I think randomized block selection was one of them, and then coin age selection. So you guys actually created something new that's even on top of those, this token mechanism. Can you maybe go through the other two and how they differ?
So, the coin stake age, sort of methodology is still something that we use in our ecosystem. The problem with coin stake age is that, there's a minimum coin stake age, and your age doesn't necessarily reset. So you can actually, we saw this in testing, because we actually were going to use that methodology. And we noticed in testing that people would say you're 3 or 4 days old, so to speak. We noticed that those nodes weren't earning as much anymore. So we found a way to basically reset your coin stake age over time so that you're re-entered into the system over and over again and have more chances to earn rewards.
Interesting. Yeah, I was actually going to ask that. Like, I was going to say, hey, if the coin age doesn't reset, then that would mean that the people who got in first have a better, higher advantage. But in this case, it does reset. So it kind of sort of levels the playing field a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're seeing, and that's what we hope will continue at scale. Right now we're running about 85 nodes on our testnet, and we're trying to get up over 100 before we launch. And everything seems to be working the way we would expect.
Fantastic. Well, folks, when we come back, we're going to talk more about cryptocurrencies, and we're going to bring our co-host back in, talk a little bit about this as well. But first, we have to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, you might say that you know, cloud storage is expensive, and the more you store in it, the more times you perform operations and access it, the more expensive it is. Now, in this day and age, it's true that most cloud storage companies, that's how they operate. Now, the cloud storage competition these days is to see how low they can get the storage fees and the ingress and egress fees. Now, I can tell you, if you try to go to the bottom or cheaper tiers of some of the cloud storage systems, you also give up performance and reliability as well. Well, these things and more is where Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage prevails. Now, if you're doing some small personal projects all the way up to enterprise projects, Wasabi seems to have figured it all out. Now, listen to this cost. 0.49 cents per gigabyte per month. And that almost equates to $4.99 per terabyte per month. Plus, listen to this game changer. Unlimited free egress for your data and no charge for API calls, so you don't have to pay to access your data. Now, you should go check out what you're already paying right now on cloud storage, because because I'm sure that you can tell yourself, not only have to include egress fees and API calls, but that is a substantial cost in your business. That's the COGS is pretty high when you have to include those things. Now, you're probably thinking, well, if they're cheaper, they must be slower, or they don't have as many features and bells and whistles, right? Well, Wasabi has really developed some disruptive technology here. They have ways to pull raw performance out of their storage devices without compromising any of that stuff. They have a revolutionary process that they lay down data on disks sequentially as opposed to blocks. Now, what happens? Well, that means that Wasabi storage is 80% cheaper and 6 times faster in speed than the industry leader. Now, are you and your organization worried about compliance? Well, Wasabi has you covered with HIPAA, FINRA, and CJS compliant as well. Wasabi offers unique features, what they call immutable buckets, that cannot be deleted or altered, thus protecting valuable data from accidental malicious destruction, which is not available in some of the other competitors out there today. Are you worried about data migration to cloud services? Well, Wasabi also has the answer here as well. With their Wasabi Ball Transfer appliance, this thing is actually powered by Netgear, and it's designed to transfer large data sets while actually dramatically reducing your costs and increasing your performance. Now, you might already have cloud storage, or your organization probably has tried to store data on premises to save money, or they're planning to do so. With Wasabi, it will have you rethinking these approaches. Now, I'll bet you are ready to go try it out, right? Well, go build something fun or move some of your data right now. Experience Wasabi for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial link, and enter the code ENTERPRISE. See how much storing in the cloud can save your business. That's wasabi.com, and enter the code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Wasabi for their support in enterprise tech. So we're talking with Nick Saponaro from Divi Project about cryptocurrency and coins. We talked a little bit about the technology a little bit, and we talked about some of the selection processes and the blockchain. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about the process of Divi Coin in the case. Now, obviously, you need to onboard to Divi Coin by giving some kind of a stake. How does that process go? Like, do you have to use some kind of an account? Like, how do you get the money into the chain?
It's pretty simple. So we're coming out with a smart wallet And it's just like you would buy any other alternative cryptocurrency. You can exchange it for Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, or what have you on an exchange. And then you send it from that exchange to your wallet on your desktop. Now, I have a demo for you of how this all works, and I can show it to you in a second.
Yeah.
So this is going to show you basically how we set up a masternode in our ecosystem. Now, if you're familiar at all with other masternodes, you know that it's an arduous process, and dashes, for example, can take even an extremely tech-savvy person hours to set up. What you're going to see here is probably the most simplified process that I've seen for setting up a masternode. You can see all you do is you select your tier. I'm going to do a copper here. You click deploy, and this actually runs all of the processes in the background. This is the only system that actually deploys a cloud server for you, runs all of the configurations, and seamlessly installs your masternode in the background. You can actually continue to use your computer while this happens and go about your day. You don't have to spend hours on the on forums and documentation trying to figure out how to set up a new masternode.
Right.
And as soon as this process is complete, you are part of that ecosystem, and you start earning your block rewards. We think most masternodes seem to earn their first block within about an hour.
Oh, wow, that's quick. This is actually provisioning and deploying on your local box here, right?
So it's actually deploying it to the cloud. So once you're done here, as you just saw that finished, you can actually go ahead and close the software, and you can close your computer, turn it off, and it's actually running in the cloud. Once you turn your computer back on and sync your wallet back up, you can see all your rewards in there, and it doesn't require a persistent connection locally. Because we deploy it to the cloud, we can guarantee that connection is persistent, backed up, etc.
Interesting. So now you guys were talking a little about how you can run it on your box, but you can also deploy it to the cloud. Now, you can deploy to any cloud service that's out there today?
So for right now, we're working with DigitalOcean. We've struck a pretty good relationship with them. In the near future, we want to offer other services like AWS, Azure, and Vulture, and the other cloud hosts. And we even want to allow for the consumer, the client, to use their own cloud host, whatever they want to use. Right now, it is a fully automated process. And in order to do that, we have, a relationship with DigitalOcean.
Great. And DigitalOcean is a sponsor of us as well. And I think it's great to also offer this kind of ability to kind of do to any whatever cloud service somebody's using, even on premise. So that's cool. Hopefully that'll be supported soon. Now, what about security? Like we talked a little, obviously people are always worried about all these things that are talking about, hey, if I commandeer a certain percentage of CPU power or the blockchain, I'll take control. Like how does this affect the proof of stake and how is it as secure as the proof of work type of mechanism?
Yeah, it's still just as, if not more so, secure. Just like with trying to stage a 51% attack against the Bitcoin network, it's extremely expensive to do that on a proof of work blockchain. It's even harder on a proof of stake blockchain just because of the inherently secure nature of staking versus hardware work. It's probably a little bit more in depth than I want to get into right now, but to simply answer, yes, it's just as secure, if not more so.
Got it. Now, I did want to bring my co-hosts back in here. I'll throw it over to you first, Brian. You had some questions about the level of the differences between some of the blockchains, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing I wanted to ask was, you talked about the low resource requirement. If I wanted to run this locally, is it, and mobile devices present a certain challenge with persistency. But what if I had, a bunch of Raspberry Pi devices, for example, laying around the house that weren't doing anything else? Is that something that I could load up DiviCoin on and start, earning my blocks?
So right now, we need to optimize for Raspberry Pi. Which is on our near-term roadmap. It's a big request from our community, but it does require some maneuvering of the technology to make sure that it works on that type of device. That said, a very small form factor PC, I know there's others that are competitive to Raspberry Pi, running Linux or something like that theoretically could work, but we haven't gotten to that part of our testing yet. So for right now, it's just your typical machines. That said, it can be a very, very basic laptop computer, for example, that could run this software no problem.
Cool. The other question I have is around the level of anonymity that is offered by Divi. One of the things that attracts a lot of people to, say, Bitcoin or Ethereum, other cryptocurrencies, is anonymity, right? Is I have a secure transaction, but it's, you know, more difficult to trace that transaction back to me if I decide to do so. Is that something that's part of the Divi project, or is that something that you work to remove the anonymity? I mean, what was the strategy? What's your strategy there?
Yeah, so it works pretty much the same as most other blockchains in that the ledger is open and viewable, but you know, all you're seeing is transaction hashes and addresses, you know, strings of addresses. One of the things we'll be adding post launch, one of the first things we'll be adding is username functionality. And although you'll be able to use the username publicly, we will offer an option to send privately, just like you have private sending on like Venmo, for example. But we wanted to keep that obviously decentralized open ledger without sacrificing the anonymity and privacy and security of the user.
That's cool. Thanks. One last question for me for right now is, so a lot of companies that are actually, you know, banks as well as technology companies looking at applications of blockchain technology beyond cryptocurrency. You know, I can think of one in my company's industry, you know, talk about trusted platform modules and ensuring, you know, the integrity of the supply chain. And one of the things that one of the applications of blockchain is potentially doing things like that. Are there any plans in a Divi project to look at applications of your blockchain implementation outside of currencies?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. I mean, we've been approached by a couple larger enterprises who are interested in a couple different use cases, one being healthcare and, of course, other supply chain things and customer onboarding, things of that nature. These companies or enterprises that are looking at using blockchain are typically doing so to lower administrative costs, I've found. Which surprised me. I had a different perspective on it, but it does make sense when you think about the audit trail and how much administrative cost goes into actually figuring out where things went from point A to point B, whether it be a health claim or you know, a product on a supply chain.
Now, Curtis, you had a question about application, right?
Well, yeah, and we've been hearing a little bit of the answer to that, because there are those who say that the primary applications for cryptocurrency as a use case for blockchain are in the developed world, are as an anonymous, often criminal way of doing transactions, and in the developing world, where the banking infrastructure is not nearly where it is in, say, North America, Europe, and Asia. My question, have you talked to people in the developing world about using this as a sort of side channel bank? And what do you say to those who look at cryptocurrency and claim that all you're doing is providing a payment infrastructure for the criminal elements?
Yeah, so I'll start with the developing world question. And I think that cryptocurrency will gain mass adoption in the developing world much sooner than it will gain it here in, you know, more developed countries like the United States, for example. You know, our banks work really well. Our payment processing systems work really well. So it's going to be hard to offer a really viable alternative to that until we are using blockchain at scale or have a scalable blockchain. Definitely in places like Africa, where they're using pretty much anything they can get their hands on as currency. I know I've talked to people who are more familiar with the topic that say that there are places in Africa where they're using calling cards as currency, basically. And it's very dangerous because it's still something you can carry, and it can be removed from your person, so to speak. So it's important for people to have control over their money and access to financial services, even if it's non-traditional, like something like a cryptocurrency application. Now, as for money laundering and illicit activities, yeah, I mean, it's obviously happening, and it's happened with every currency that's ever been created. But it's not the only reason that people use cryptocurrency peer-to-peer. You know, I get paid in cryptocurrency, for example. I'm happy to take that as a salary because I see the potential in it. And it's just much easier to maintain. I'm not relying on the central banking system to hold my money, and I can access and control it how I wish. I think that the whole criminal thing, people say that a lot, and I think it's been kind of blown up. But I see more and more real stores accepting Bitcoin, accepting Ethereum, stores transitioning entirely over to cryptocurrency, even in some cases. So as we move forward, I think we'll see more public blockchains that sort of facilitate the non-illicit behaviors, less anonymity in the blockchains that are coming out.
Now, what about holding false transactions accountable? Now, I think Ethereum uses Casper or something like that, where they basically take away some of your stake based off of malicious validators. They slash it. Is there something that Divi's doing that's kind of similar, or how do they kind of hold these types of things accountable?
I'm sorry, you kind of broke up right in the beginning. You said Ethereum's using something to validate.
I think it was Casper. Is it Casper or something like that, where they say they basically hold malicious validators accountable by removing some of their stake?
Right. So that is kind of, and Casper has not been implemented to my knowledge on the Ethereum blockchain yet, but they're working very hard to do that. And it's for good reason, because with proof of stake, which is what they're trying to transition to and what we are already using, if your stake is a participant in a malicious activity, whether that be trying to stage an attack on the network or try to change transactions, double spend, things like that, your stake is removed and you're kicked from the network pretty much automatically. And we've definitely gone through a lot of testing on that. That was pretty hard to fine tune, because we were sometimes kicking people who weren't acting maliciously in the beginning. But now that we've gotten that dialed in, we can see that it works aggressively and very well.
Got it. Now, obviously, DiviCoin is kind of, in good company with some big players out there. Like you were talking about Ethereum, Litecoin, Monero, Dash, Bitcoin, Zcash. Now, I'm just curious, do you guys feel that these are just kind of cohorts, and or are they kind of are they just targets to gain market share? Like, how do you guys feel about the competition?
I think cryptocurrency is a very unique space when it comes to competition. Because of its decentralized nature and open source nature, it kind of belongs to anyone who's developing with it or on it. I don't think there's going to be an end-all, be-all cryptocurrency. And as much as I would love for Divi to be that, the cryptocurrency that becomes that may not exist yet. I don't think we'll see the Google and Apple and Facebook behemoths of cryptocurrency, because the ecosystem is it's more decentralized in its nature. It can work interoperably, and it should. And that's the philosophy behind the whole scheme, right?
Right. Now, you know, DiviCoin is open source, right? I thought I saw something out on GitHub.
That's correct. Yes.
So you guys are all the new features and everything is just kind of floating out there, and people can actually make pull requests and everything right against the real thing.
That's correct. We try to do pretty much weekly commits to the public GitHub. We do most of our development privately, but then we push everything publicly when we feel confident in the quality of the code. So yeah, you can start to develop with it or fork it and make your own coin. Right now, I've been personally working on an API library that implements some of the functionality in JavaScript, so people can start to develop their own little applications using our ecosystem that way as well.
Fantastic. Well, we've been talking with Nick Saponero from the Divi Project. one of the co-founders there. Nick, thank you so much for being here on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Can you maybe just tell the folks at home where they can find Divi Coin, Divi Project? How can they get signed up? How can they get started? And also where they can find you and your works?
Sure. Come find us on Telegram. It's just t.me/DiviProject. You can obviously find us on our website and our blog. We're all over social media. And we're happy to talk to you. I'm in the Telegram personally, and you can reach out to me directly if you have any questions whatsoever.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being here. We actually, this is a great topic. We'll have to have you back again. I know we had just two times, but we definitely want to hear how things progress. So thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. Look forward to next time.
Well, unfortunately, folks, we've run out of time. You've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 masternodes. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host, without whom I wouldn't want to do this show. Let's start with Brian. What are you up to? What are you doing? Where can people find you? Where can people know what's going on with you? Where can they go?
Thanks, Lou. As always, you can find me on Twitter at BA McHenry, which you see there in the bottom of the screen. Also on devcentral.f5.com, where it's a really active community of F5 administrators, engineers, and just about anybody that wants to mess around with F5 technology. And I want to give a quick shout out to my wife this week for the cool BAM t-shirt that you see me wearing.
Nice. Fantastic. Set up your brand there. There you go. Fantastic. Of course, we have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, as always, all my writing is going to be over at Dark Reading. That's darkreading.com. I will almost always tweet about my new stories on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA. And got a couple of good pieces coming up in the next week. I've got a big thing on artificial intelligence. Been doing a lot of research on that. Have another how-to coming out. And then there'll be just some newsworthy goodness coming out. So come on over to Dark Reading, take a look, and let me know what you think about the articles I write.
Fantastic. Curtis, Brian, thanks again. We look forward to having you guys on again soon. Also, thank you to you, to the person who drops in each and every week, watch and listens to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We wouldn't have this show without you, so we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. Go to the show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, plus of all of our show notes, information about our co-hosts, guest information, and the links to the stories during the show. But more importantly, next to the videos there, you'll get those really helpful download or subscribe links to support our show by getting audio versions, video versions, HD video versions, and listen on any one of your devices. It's pretty much the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Now, after you subscribe, share the show with your friends and your neighbors and your family and your coworkers. We love doing this show, and with your support, we can keep doing it. Now, after you subscribe, also remember, we do this show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. Come see how the show is run. Now, of course, next week, we actually have a pretty good guest. We have Torch 3D to talk a little bit about AR and VR platform. So come back and check that out. Of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well as irc.twit.tv. We love the chat room, and we always get pretty good discussions out of there. So come on and visit us there. Now, also don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. You get to see what I do in my normal job during the week at Microsoft. Check out dev.office.com, where we post all the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience and your productivity. Also, look out for Microsoft Ignite coming out here at the end of the month. We're going to be debuting some cool technologies, so check us out there. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially thank you to Leo and Lisa for continuing to support us each and every week so we can do This Week in Enterprise Tech. I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit as well, and of course, Mr. Brian Chi, who is our tireless producer. He makes the show possible, and he helps us run the show smoothly. He's in the chat room here, kind of directing things right now. So thank you, Brian. And of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for this week, Kevin. Like we always do, we have to continue our tradition and ask, what are the two types of node selection algorithms in the blockchain?
Master nodes and apprentice nodes.
Oh, I'm so close. Unfortunately, the answer we're looking for is randomized block selection and Coinbase selection. But thank you for trying. Maybe next time you'll get it right. Thank you, Kevin. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.